Welcome to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. I'm Justine Toe.
And I'm Natasha Moore.
Well, one of the things we do around here at CPX is to watch the culture and the society around us and see if we can plot the trends that are happening. You know, in some ways, reading the tea leaves of the time and bringing to light all those unspoken assumptions and truths that we have operating in our culture that we often don't interrogate very much.
Each of us at CPX has kind of our own preoccupations as individuals, and Justine and I have both been writing recently about some trends that can be difficult to pin down just because they're so entrenched in our day-to-day thinking and conversation. So we thought we'd have a go today at trying to make the invisible, the things that we take for granted, a bit more visible. So see if you agree with us that these are characteristics of the way that we think and speak today.
And later we're going to talk about something called the sex myth. And yes, Natasha is implying that I think about sex a lot.
preoccupation.
But first, Natasha, you've been thinking a lot lately about evolutionary psychology and the way that it's seeped into our thinking about, well, about lots of things, really.
Mm.
Well, firstly, what is evolutionary psychology and why do you have a problem with it?
Well, I mean, there are some important distinctions here. So evolutionary biology is a scientific discipline that focuses on certain biological changes that have taken place within the human species.
Like opposable thumbs,
yeah, that kind of thing. Evolutionary psychology is a discipline that tries to figure out what those changes mean for the ways that we behave today. How do they explain the ways that we eat or relate to one another, the way that we date or whatever it is? The criticism that I kind of want to make is not so much of evolutionary psychology itself and certainly not of evolutionary biology. The problem that I've been kind of thinking about, and this is something I've been noticing more and more, you see it everywhere, it kind of really frustrates me, is the way that we popularly talk about evolutionary psychology, the ways that we use it, that I think we do that in quite unscientific ways.
Well, can you give us an example of what you mean?
Yeah, so there are loads of potential examples. I read something recently in the context of attachment parenting, which is a school of parenting. You'll know more about this than I will,
yes.
About whether you should let your baby cry and whether you should pick it up and all that kind of thing. So one of the things, it says that controlled crying, when you just let the baby cry until it stops, that's terrible for the child because actually it thinks that you've abandoned it. And as back in the days of living in the tribe, it would have, you know, felt that, well, my parents have left and now I'm going to be attacked by a predator. It extinguishes its cries to avoid the predator hearing it. That's what's going on with the baby, and that's really upsetting for it, which so, basically is made up, right?
Because, well, hang on, wait. So the thinking is that the modern day baby cries and stops crying when it realizes it's no one's coming to get it because it's...
It's been encoded into it, some sort of survival
instinct that says, if I make too much noise, I'm going to get eaten.
Yeah. So when you think about it, there's no earthly way of verifying that. You know, the baby could equally have stopped crying because it wasn't working and it got over it, whatever it was upset about. So, I mean, you do have examples that are more scientific, but bad science as well. So the science writer, Ben Goldacre, he writes this great article about a study that came out a few years ago, which claimed this is the reason we figured it out why women like pink is because they needed to be able to recognize the berries when they went out gathering berries in the tribe.
Right, the women are the gatherers.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And he kind of points out all the reasons why this is so unscientific that, you know, we don't know anything really. We know very little about life in the Pleistocene era. And actually, we have really good evidence that the female preference for pink is culturally determined. And it wasn't even the case 100, 150 years ago. And it's not the case in other cultures, in non-Western cultures. So, you know, this kind of pseudoscience goes around really easily. Someone says, oh, this is because we used to be hunter-gatherers. But we have some pretty tenuous links going on there.
And this is why you want to call it a myth, because... It's not falsifiable.
Yeah, it's very fluid.
And it disregards the role of culture.
We can kind of make it say whatever we want. So if you want to go, oh, monogamy is unrealistic because, you know, people used to live this way in the tribe. We used to have these kinds of courtship rituals. We used to live for this length of time. The fact that we don't actually know whether those things are the case, whether life used to be like that, you know, should be a problem. So I think, the fluidity of the stories are part of what makes it mythical. I think it's also that it works for us as a kind of origin story. So it has this, it's taken as having this enormous explanatory power. So rather than just being one of the things that explains why we behave the way we do or who we are as people, it's supposed to exhaustively explain us. Everything about us that we do can be traced back to the need to survive in a hostile environment, or the need to find a mate and reproduce, that kind of thing. So it's taken as this comprehensive explanation.
It's become the story of all the stories. But surely there are some things that evolutionary psychology can tell us about ourselves. Are you just saying here and now that is just all pointless?
I wouldn't have the qualifications to do that even if that were the case. No, I think evolutionary psychology is really interesting. And, you know, surely there are ways that our biology does influence us and our behaviour. You know, we're physical creatures. We have this incredibly complex physical systems, and they've come from an incredibly complex process. So you would think that those sorts of things do have some influence on why we do the things we do and why we think and speak the ways we do. But, you know, other things do as well, surely. So we've had, on top of, you know, however many hundreds of thousands of years of living in tribes, say, we've also had thousands of years of living in certain cultures, and you know, however many years or decades of living in a particular culture, each of us. And so those things also strongly explain why we behave the ways that we do. So I think it gets a bit ridiculous when we try to pretend that everything we do traces back to our biology. So Marilyn Robinson, who's kind of my favourite novelist, she has written and spoken a bit about this, and she kind of jokes that, you know, Leonardo da Vinci and Plato and Aristotle,
they
according
were just
to
really looking for a mate,
that's
sort
right
of thing.
You know, that do we really think that philosophy and art and everything just comes back to the need to find a mate, these incredibly complex but pointless evolutionary spin-offs. So I think that deep down we all know that humans are more than that. More than our biology. We don't really just love our families or sacrifice for other people because, you know, there's some form of survival instinct that takes over. So I think we can learn from the findings of biology and psychology without writing off all the thinking that philosophers and theologians and artists have done over the millennia about who and what we are as humans. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. And Justine and I are talking about a couple of modern myths. We think of ourselves as a very scientific, rational age. You know, myths are something that older, superstitious cultures had the need for. But we've both been thinking lately about elements of our culture that could easily be described as mythical. We've just been talking about some of the more outlandish uses of evolutionary psychology. Justine, you've been writing about something a bit sexier.
Yes.
Just a warning to listeners, if you have little ones listening in, we're not going to get graphic here or anything, but we are going to discuss sex and its significance in our culture. So an article, Justine, that you wrote recently was called Great Sexpectations. I really like the pun. And it talked about the modern sex myth. What is that?
Well, this is all from Rachel Hill's book, The Sex Myth, and she says, she defines the sex myth quite loosely, really. She says that it can involve this media panic over this hypersexualized society, that everyone is just always at it, and, you know, and the way that she explains this is that we always think that other people's sex lives are way better than ours. So she says that's one component of the sex myth. But the part that really interests me when she talks about the sex myth is how she says that we place sex on a pedestal and almost make it the most supreme thing that we can aspire to in life, and it assumes such an importance that we end up judging our own worth and value based on the sex that we're having or the sex that we're not having. So it's quite a pervasive sense in our society today that if you're not engaging in sex of some kind, then you're a bit of a loser. And that goes straight to the heart of the sex myth, because it encourages people to link who they are as a person, or, you know, what their identity is with the type of sex and what sex they're having. And so she wants to call this myth out.
So is this something that's shifted with the sexual revolution? Has that sort of not delivered on its promises?
I really appreciated her critique of this because she tells this story about how before the sexual revolution, we were under the control of a repressive sexual regime, let's say, that's bounded by Christian morality, let's say, where sex is only good for reproduction and sex is something dirty if you do it too much and all the rest of it. So it has to be done in particular ways in order to be acceptable. Her story is that we've now been liberated from this particular sexual regime, but in fact, we've actually just traded it for another sexual regime that now says that if you aren't doing it enough, then you also aren't living up to the standards that you should be. So there's one example she gives, which I thought was fascinating. This lady that she speaks to, she's in her 20s. She's been dating her boyfriend and they've been living together now for, you know, since they were in high school. But she also has quite radical left politics. But people, she says, are really amazed that she is so radical and so politically liberal, but at the same time she conducts this monogamous existence with this one partner that she's had, her high school sweetheart, and they've been together ever since. She was saying that this girl actually feels worried about who she is as a person because her sexual life does not live up to her empowered, liberated identity that her politics might give rise to. So that disjunction, I think, is quite interesting. And Hills would also say that, you know, we may have given up one repressive sexual regime, but we've just traded it for another that says you have to be like this.
It still demands conformity.
Yeah, absolutely.
You use the phrase in your article, apocalyptic romance, which I think is such a great phrase. What's it talking about? I'm kind of picturing, you know, a post-apocalyptic movie with a love plot. That's not actually what it's about, right?
No. And I really wish it was my turn, but it's not. It actually comes from Ernest Becker in his book, The Denial of Death. And he basically says that the sort of security and the existential recognition and the significance that we used to seek in God and in the transcendent, we've now swapped that and now we're seeking that in the other person romantically, because it's like God and the transcendent has been stripped away from our culture. So he's basically saying that our issues with sex, our issues with love are actually a theological problem because it's all sparked by the absence of God. All the thing that you sought formerly in God is now redirected and sought in the other person, which I think explains about, you know, 100% of all the romantic comedies out there where it's like it's all about trying to find that perfect person and ride off into the sunset with this idea that I will be fixed, I will be complete when I find that other person.
So the problem is kind of one of emphasis?
Yeah, I mean, and this is why I bring up Augustine. He's the 4th century bishop. In my article, you might think, why bring this guy from...
For modern sex.
Yeah, for modern sex. But he's really interested in the way that human beings are a passionate people and we're driven by what we love. And I think that has a real purchase in our discussion today about sex and love. Because he says, Augustine says, that God is the supreme love object. And if we love him rightly, then that will order our loves of everything else. And he says that humans are made to worship God, but if they don't worship God, they'll actually worship something else in his place. So something like money or power or sex can take God's place, and then we end up worshipping sex. But that God of money, power or sex doesn't ultimately satisfy, and we can't keep our appetites, let's say, for that God under control. And so that leads us down this very wayward path where all our loves can go awry. So you hear people today talking about love addictions or sex addictions. That seems to me a key way in which our passions and our loves can't operate the way that they're meant to if they're not directed at the right thing.
So what does that say for sexuality? Where does that fit then within that Christian view of the world and of our loves? Does it still have a significant place?
Yeah, it does have a significant place. But I think key to understanding Augustine's understanding of the whole thing is that sex should enjoy its right and proper place within the grand scheme of things. So, you know, Augustine would agree with Rachel Hills that you don't want to make too much of sex, but at the same time, he might say to her, you don't want to make too little of it either, because she starts to say, you know, whatever you do is whatever you do, all good, don't make it too much about who you are and all the rest of it. Whereas he would say, no, there is a significance to it as well. And it's about it having the right place within the scheme of our loves. And so if God, he says, is your supreme love object, then all the other loves can fall into place nicely, including sex.
Well, it's good to think about some of these ways of thinking that are often so ingrained that we don't even notice them. I hope you've enjoyed these discussions of pop evolutionary psychology and of our culture's great sexpectations. For more on these topics or for other CPX content, you can visit our website at publicchristianity.org. Thanks for joining us. See you next time on Life and Faith.